If we realize that military might has not brought about what we desire, we should look for other ways in order to see what kind of perceptions the terrorists have of themselves and the United States of America.
The evidence suggests that without coordination by the people at the top to suspend the standard operation procedures, they're just not going to happen.
And my mother, it was like I had just hit her in the stomach with a baseball bat. She just bent over, and she just started, like, saying his name. And she said, I don't want any other family to have to feel the pain that I'm feeling right now.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, September 11th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Two years after the most horrific attack on U.S. soil in contemporary times, the shock has dissipated. The memory is more distant, but the fears remain. Poll after poll released on the eve of today's second anniversary of the terrorist strikes on New York and Washington find Americans more fearful and fatalistic than they were a year ago. Carol Doherty of the Pew Research Center says the prevalent view in this country is that they can strike again anywhere, anytime, and the government can't stop it, she says. The apocalyptic fear is definitely here to stay, at least in the foreseeable future. Part of what may be feeding into the fear for many Americans are the number of unanswered questions lingering around the events of that fateful day. According to CNN, efforts to fully investigate the matter have been influenced by the White House, as the president himself personally asked Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to limit the congressional investigation into 911 in January of 2002. One of the most obvious yet critical questions being asked, why the attacks were not prevented. A congressional report released this summer blamed CIA and FBI lapses. William Davis, an associate professor at Kent State University, has compiled the body of investigative journalism around September 11, 2001, and concludes that the entire U.S. intelligence community knew of the 911 attacks beforehand, including the fact that commercial jets were to be used as bombs. Davis questions why planes were permitted to leave Dulles Airport almost an hour after the first plane hit the World Trade Center, and wonders why NORAD did not intercept the plane that hit the Pentagon.
I mean, the system is a very hierarchical system, and the congressional report, the official stories, is that basically, you know, there were lapses, there was incompetence. But when you have such a system, if there is lower-level incompetence in which the security system and the standard operation procedures which people have to carry out by law, if that failed, you see, that's going to be caught at the time, you know, some people at the top. So basically, what I'm saying is the evidence suggests that without coordination by the people at the top to suspend the standard operation procedures, they're just not going to happen that way. They're
so then someone from the top had to give the orders.
Yeah, they had to give the orders, had to be coordinated. Because the other thing is, of course, my emphasis is, you see, on accountability. So none of these people have been held accountable. Yeah, a lot of cover-up in terms of what happened.
Couldn't one just go up the chain of command and figure out where the responsibility or accountability would lie in a situation like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, sure.
Well, when you say somebody in the Bush administration, can you narrow that down? Any who in the Bush administration and what?
Well, there's
the
National Security Agency and Joint Chiefs of Staff. Those people are, and certainly, yeah, the president has a responsibility.
Walter E. Davis is an associate professor at Kent State University. His paper is titled September 11th and the Bush Administration, Compelling Evidence for Complicity. The entire report can be found at www.informationclearinghouse.info/article4582. Two by two, they stepped forward at Ground Zero today, the sons and daughters, nieces and nephews, grandsons and granddaughters of the September 11th victims, mournfully reciting the 2,792 names of the World Trade Center dead. For a second straight year, the nation paused on a bright September morning to recall the day when hijacked jetliners slammed into the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and a field in Pennsylvania, killing more than 3,000 people, each morning in a manner that suits himself. In other breaking news, the Israeli Security Cabinet has voted in principle to expel Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. According to the BBC, the cabinet is understood to have asked the army to draw up a series of options for Arafat's expulsion from his compound in the West Bank town of Ramallah. The decision comes after Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon convened an urgent meeting of cabinet ministers to consider their response to suicide bombings on Monday that killed 15 people. No action against Arafat is expected to be taken right away, although Israeli troops are reported to have taken control of buildings close to Arafat's headquarters today in advance of the cabinet meeting. Well, as President Bush uses the anniversary of September 11th to claim progress in fighting the war on terror and possibly expand it beyond Iraq and Afghanistan, we're going to listen today on Peace Watch to the stories of people for whom the terrorist attacks not only provided a life-altering experience, but determined their roles as lifelong peacemakers. They're the mothers, wives, sisters, and brothers of people who were killed in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon 2 years ago, and they formed themselves into a group called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. In the months following the attacks, Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian followed several members of this group as they took part in a walk for peace between Washington, D.C. and New York City. He also had the opportunity to sit down with Amber Amundson, Colleen Kelly, Phyllis Rodriguez, and David Patorti to listen to their stories. We present now the first part of an hour-long audio documentary he produced.
I was at work. I work at DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx. I'm a nurse practitioner there, and we have a health center that's inside the school. And I remember that morning because it was this beautiful, sunny September morning, and it was really gorgeous outside, not a cloud in the sky. I also remember that morning because it was the first day that my daughter didn't cry when I dropped her off at kindergarten. So I thought to myself, boy, this is going to be a pretty good day.
We have a 17-month-old baby, and when you have a baby, you pretty much start your day with the sound of a baby crying, and either you or your wife gets up. So that morning, that Tuesday morning, it was my turn to sleep in. So I got to sleep in until 8:45. And I was sort of stirring in my bed, and my wife and child noticed that I was getting up. So they came into the bedroom, and they both got in bed with me, which is kind of fun. You know, you got the little baby between you, and you're kind of hanging out.
That day, I had decided to start a new exercise regimen, and I left very early in the morning for a one-hour walk. I came back later than I had expected. I wanted to be back by about 9, but I had taken a wrong turn, and the walk ended up being longer than I planned, so I got in about 9:20. And as I was entering our building, the porter told me that one of the Trade Center towers was on fire.
When I got to work, I was on the phone with one of the nuns that I work with at another part-time job, a free clinic, and she had told me that a plane had hit the World Trade Center when we first started talking, and I just remember just feeling really bad and really frightened and anxious. But I do remember looking at the clock, and it was at 9:23 that we were speaking, and we both agreed that it was too upsetting to talk about a certain patient at that point and that we would speak the next day.
And I was really grumpy, and I hadn't slept well because I had gotten up with him in the middle of the night. And we went in the kitchen. We were having breakfast. I had just finished breakfast. I was holding a cup of coffee and had gone out the back door of our house and was standing on the deck, sort of taking some deep breaths and trying to wake up. And the phone rings, and the baby starts crying, and my wife is trying to hear who's on the phone, and she can't, and, you know, it's my mom, and she's saying something crazy. And so she hands me the phone, and my mom says, I'm really worried about the kamikazes. And I said, what? You know, the World Trade Center. And I said, what? You know, they hit, you know, planes hit the World Trade Center. And I just didn't know what she was talking about.
So I ran upstairs, and I didn't even know which tower Greg worked in. I didn't know what floor. I just knew the company and that he was down there. And I ran upstairs and put on the TV, and I came home on time to see the second plane hit the second tower, and it was then, first it was absolutely overwhelming, like for everybody, and I thought it was an accident. And when I saw the second one hit, it didn't look like an accident anymore.
I began the day like most other days. I walked our son Elliot to school and came back and began to work in the flower garden with our daughter Charlotte. The phone rang and I answered it. It was Craig, and he called to tell me that the first plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. He thought that maybe it may have been a malfunction with the engine, and we weren't really sure about it. And he said he would keep me posted as he gained any information. We said, I love you to each other, and let each other go. And I went back to caring for flowers with Charlotte.
And I came back in, and my wife had the TV on, and there, you know, there was that image of that tower just burning, you know. And I just remember walking in and seeing that, and just my stomach just dropping. And I can't remember, this must have been, I must have seen it live when that second plane hit. I remember just sitting there, what was that, half an hour later? So I must have turned it on just as the second plane hit, and it was like, what is going on?
My sisters were calling, asking for my brother's cell phone number because they just wanted to check in and make sure he was okay, and they're not familiar with the city and weren't quite sure where his offices were. So I remember reassuring them that Billy was fine. He worked miles away from the World Trade Center, and that his building was really nowhere near where things were happening. And about 10 minutes later, the phone rang again, and it was Craig. This time, he sounded a bit more frantic and told me that a second plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. And we were both very sad, but felt a sense of security, and I felt safe, and Craig felt safe, and we said goodbye to each other, again saying, I love you.
I'm sitting on the edge of the couch, and, you know, I'm trying to ask my mom, trying to remind myself, you know, what floor was he on, and which building, you know, which tower was he in, because I couldn't remember, because he had just started working there 3 years ago. They had moved his office. And she said he was on the 95th floor, and I, you know, I knew the building was 110 stories tall, so I'm sort of mentally counting the stories, and it sure looked like the 95th floor that got hit. And I just remember that feeling like throwing up, being really nauseous, because I realized it wasn't like I could say, oh, he was on the 18th floor. That's, you know, it's nowhere near where that plane was. It was exactly where the plane was.
I had some messages on the machine, and the first message was from him, and it said, there's been a disaster at the Trade Center, but I'm okay. Call Elizabeth. I kept the TV on for news, and I also spent the next hour frantically calling all our family, close family, to tell them Greg was okay. And I had assumed, and people asked me, including my daughter-in-law, my mother, my daughter, where was he when he called? And I said, well, of course he was out of the building. Who would call from inside a burning building? Who would stop and make a phone call? Because we didn't know what was going on.
Then my sister called me about 11:20. It was very difficult that day to talk to anyone on the phone. It was very difficult for phone calls to come in or out of New York City, and she called me, and I remember her exact words. She said, I'm really sorry to have to be the one to tell you this, but Billy was there. And I just remember screaming, you know, no, a lot, because I didn't want that to be true.
I just stood there staring at that screen, or sitting on the edge of the couch, and we hung the phone up because his wife, Nikki, down in Princeton, was frantic, and she was calling around, and we wanted to keep the phones clear. And the thing I do remember is when the first tower fell and that smoke started shooting horizontally out of the tower, and it looked like an explosion had gone off or something, and the thing just started coming down, and I just remember yelling out loud, like, you know, what, I don't know what I said, but I just realized at that moment that I didn't know where my brother was, but if he was still in that building, there was no chance that he was going to get out. And it was that final when you saw that thing come down. And then when the second one came down, it was just, you know, there's just nothing there. So it was a feeling of literal nausea, of just wanting to throw up.
I felt compelled to go up into our home and turn on the TV. And at that time, I saw that the Pentagon had also been hit by an airplane. I immediately tried to call Craig and was unable to reach him.
And then the next thing I remember is my coworkers just surrounding me and helping me through, helping me breathe. I really felt like I couldn't breathe. And they called my husband, and I just wanted to be home. I just wanted to be with my children and with my husband and be home in my home here in the Bronx, just feeling that this would be a safe place, that whatever was happening in downtown Manhattan wouldn't reach up here.
And the day progressed with no news from Craig, and into the evening I still had not heard from him, and the next day again still not hearing from him.
So about midnight that night of the 11th, a good friend of mine, John Kruger, offered to take the train with me down into New York City, and we did that. We couldn't get further on the trains in Grand Central Station, but it was very striking that the city was very quiet and still and calm. I think I realized later that my hope had been that there would be all this activity, that there would be ambulances and EMS workers and people being brought to emergency rooms at kind of, you know, a real frantic pace. And what became very clear very quickly through each hospital that we did visit was that there were no survivors, that there was personnel waiting outside in the triage areas of each hospital that we visited, waiting for people, the injured, and there just were no people to treat. And I think on some level, I began to realize that evening that my brother was not alive. And although I wasn't ready to give up hope, that the chances were very, very slim.
It's hard to remember, but in the immediate aftermath of this attack, there really was nothing coming out of Manhattan. I don't think anybody could call out, couldn't call in. So for like 3 days, we really had hope that he was alive. And we had friends checking hospitals, going door to door in hospitals, and his company was trying to get rosters of people that were at hospitals. And so we would just, you know, go to bed with this sinking feeling every night that, you know, maybe he's somewhere, you know, he has a head injury, he can't say who he is, or they didn't identify him, or he got ferried over to New Jersey, or whatever.
My 31-year-old son, Greg, worked with Cantor Fitzgerald on the 103rd floor of the first tower, and the CEO of Cantor, Howard Lutnick, did something which really was wonderful, and I think other companies did it, and eventually the city did it too. He organized a family center at the Hotel Pierre, where families and friends could gather. It was a tremendous support group, like a huge living room, where you could be with other people in the same position as you. And also, if you so much as wrinkled an eyebrow, someone would touch you and say, "Are you okay? Can I help you?"
By Friday, we had driven up to Princeton to see Nikki, his wife, and then we drove up to Ithaca to see my folks. And I remember we were eating dinner and the doorbell rang, and, you know, Mom got up, went to the front door, and there was nobody there, which was very odd. And then the phone rang. Nikki checked in and said, you know, she talked to a couple people from his company, and one of them knew where he was sitting. She got the floor plan of the building, and somebody else was in a building nearby that had actually seen the first plane hit, and it took out 8 floors of the building, and that was one of the floors was his, and that there was just no way that he even survived that initial hit, you know. By the time we knew about it, when we woke up, it was pretty much precisely when I was sitting in bed with my wife and child that morning. That's when he got hit.
Our hopes were dashed on Wednesday night, the 12th, because the CEO of Cantor, Howard Lutnick, got his people and volunteers from other companies to put their business know-how to work and their research know-how to work. And they saved us the work of having to go to individual hospitals. They got all the survivors list. They really combed through everything in the whole area, wherever survivors, wherever anyone was taken for treatment. And also the morgues and stuff like that. And so they compiled all these lists centralized. And he, on Wednesday, early evening, Wednesday the 12th, he took the microphone at the Hotel Pierre, and he announced that they feel they had done an exhaustive search, and that anyone who was not on a survivor list had not survived. We should assume had not survived. So Cantor lost 7/10 of its workforce because they were on the upper floors, the most prestigious floors.
I herded my family, my mom and dad and my wife, into the living room, and I sat down and just told them, you know, the conversation I had just had. And my mother, you know, it was like I had just hit her in the stomach with a baseball bat. She just bent over, and she just started kind of, it's the sound I have never heard before from her. It was just like coming from just really deep inside of her body, just sort of this husky kind of, I mean, I can't even duplicate it, just sort of a groan coming from really deep inside of her body, series of groans. And she just started, like, saying his name. And she said, it hurts, it hurts. And she said, I don't want any other family to have to feel the pain that I'm feeling right now. And she didn't qualify that. She didn't say, I don't want any other American family to feel that way. You know, she didn't qualify it. And I've sort of taken that statement with me from my mom that I don't want any other family to feel this pain either.
It was almost instantly that I really accepted that Craig was not coming home, that I immediately had a concern for women in our country that would be dealing with what I'm dealing with and losing the father of their child. I then began to think about what is happening there, and I didn't want women there to be going through what I was going through because of what happened to Craig.
Anyone. I want those who were behind this brought to justice and punished. Really, you know, I feel people need to be punished for these horrific deeds. But I'm not sure bombing another country is the solution. My family, you know, although we really disagree about my viewpoints on this, one thing that we can agree about is that we know how badly we feel about losing my brother. And we also know that there are families in Afghanistan that feel just as badly now because of civilian deaths that have happened from the bombing.
Don't feel that killing of innocent people is justified. And I feel that an Afghani life is equal in importance to my son's life. I'm not saying that I favor killing of people who are guilty of crimes. I don't either. I mean, I'm firmly opposed to the death penalty. It's been put to the test. I felt this way before, and I would wonder sometime if I would be able to hold on to my strong feelings against it. But there are no doubts in my mind.
Well, it's funny when your brother dies, it's like a movie. And when I went up to Ithaca, our hometown, shortly after his death, I was just walking around, and everywhere you turn, there was like a flashback. You know how a movie would just go into the sort of the sepia-toned image? And it was like, here's the street where he pushed my go-kart into our neighbor's flower bed. You know, and I haven't thought about that in, what, 30 years or 40 years. And here's where he was pushing me on my bicycle with a training wheel. Or it was the first time that I didn't have training wheels on my bicycle, and he was pushing me, and he let me go, and I didn't realize it. And I turned around and realized he wasn't holding me, and I fell over because I realized that he wasn't holding me. You know, those kind of old memories. And a lot of regrets. You know, he was 52, I'm 45. And it's sort of like the Beatles, you know, you're really close when you're young, and then you sort of all grow up and you go your separate ways. And we were geographically separated for a while. I was on the West Coast and he was in New York, and we sort of fell out of touch, and we weren't super close. And then I moved back to the East Coast and had a child, and we were really starting to get back in touch again, you know, the way the kids bring families back together. It sort of gives you an excuse to get back together and send each other presents and make phone calls and send pictures and stuff. So there's a lot of regret about that, the sense that we were all just kind of getting back together again, and then just as soon as it began to happen, it stopped.
Billy was a really unique guy. He grew up with four sisters, so I guess that kind of made him the prince of the family growing up. But I think that gave him a real sensitive side. He was always the guy who, if say there's a party or a gathering, Billy somehow would seek out whoever seemed to be a little uncomfortable in a room full of people, and would somehow connect with him because of his very varied interests, whether it was surfing or duck hunting or the business world or being a chef or a bartender. He'd somehow make a connection with that person and help put them at ease. And time again, since my brother's death and at his memorial service and through letters my family has received, countless people have written stories about my brother in that way, how he helped them through some small, difficult time, whether it was just a singular event like a party or, you know, a guy from his homeroom in high school came up at the memorial service and just said how Bill came up to him his first day of school because he realized he was a new guy and it was junior year. And they became friends.
It's interesting that almost right after he passed away, I started thinking about food. Because we're Italians, and we like to eat, and we like to cook. And food has just been this very important part of our lives. And when he died, I started thinking about all of these wonderful foods that we grew up eating and enjoying that he would never get to enjoy again. And a year ago, almost at this time, Jim was down at my house. I live in North Carolina now. I used to live in New York. And my whole family was down there. My parents were there. They're still alive. And we were cooking this meal that we cook every Christmas. And it's a Sicilian Christmas Eve dinner. And it's fish-based. And it includes linguine with clam sauce and oysters that are breaded and fried and shrimp cocktail and polenta and bacala, which is this dried salt codfish, and tomato sauce with garlic, and you put it on polenta. And we make this every year. We've done it every year for as long as I can remember. And we eat it, and then a few hours later we go to church. And we go to midnight mass on Christmas Eve. And I just kept thinking about that meal and realizing that I didn't know that was the last time we'd be making it together, was last year. And here it is almost a year later, and look at how different the world is. It strikes me that when you kill someone, you're not just killing a person, you're killing their history, and you're killing their heritage, and their memories, and all those connections you have to their parents, and their grandparents, and their great-grandparents, and you're also killing the connections that my brother would have had with my son, who's 17 months old. You know, my brother was his uncle for about a year and a half, and now he has one less uncle. So it's more than just killing a person. You're damaging something that's going to be damaged for many years and many generations. It's going to take place for a long, long time. ¶¶
Craig was an active duty multimedia illustrator for the Deputy Chief of Staff of Personnel Command at the Pentagon, who was also killed. Craig had an idea about the military and how it could create a more peaceful global community. In fact, he drove to work every day with a Visualize World Peace bumper sticker on his car. I believe that Craig would be as scared as I am about the retaliation and military efforts going on in Afghanistan, particularly because he really believed that military force and bombing just continues to foster hatred. He believed first in exhausting all other ways of bringing justice before retaliation.
When he was 14, he went for a month to Salamanca on an exchange with the Spanish class in the high school, lived with a family, and then the following summer, the families came to us and lived with us. When he came home and he learned that the Spanish didn't like the French, he said that he thought that nationalism wasn't good, that nationalism stinks. Why should people hate each other just because of what country they grow up in?
I think Billy would probably be for the military action. Just knowing him and how he felt about other issues, I think he'd be very supportive of it. My own thoughts are quite different. And although my brother and I would probably disagree about the response of the United States, I'm certain that he would be supportive of me expressing my opinion and supportive of having a discussion about this. And I think that's probably what is the most troublesome to me in my country's response, is that I don't feel there was a lot of discussion about how we should respond. And I don't feel like there was any alternatives, really, any concrete or plausible alternatives presented to the people of the United States about other ways that this tragedy could be addressed.
We've been in contact with a group called Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. It's an anti-death penalty group made up of families of murder victims. It also includes families of people who have been executed for capital crimes and families of people who are on death row. I guess now they're broadening to include us. And I really like their approach. They're people who understand this kind of loss. They have a book called Not in My Name, and that really sums up the way I feel. No more killing in my name.
And it was difficult because as I started to speak out, I realized that there was a lot of opposition to the things that I was saying. And when I would say that I didn't want another woman anywhere in the world to feel that way, and I certainly wouldn't want to be part of that, people were really confused. So then I felt a need to clarify what I was saying and really be public with it. I felt really an urgency because almost immediately, I think October 9th, we began bombing.
Amber Amundsen's husband, Craig Scott Amundsen, worked in the Pentagon. Phyllis Rodriguez's son, Greg, and David Patorti's brother, Jim, worked in the World Trade Center. And Colleen Kelly's brother, Billy, was attending a morning business meeting in the World Trade Center's Windows on the World restaurant on September 11, 2001. Amber, Phyllis, David, and Colleen are members of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. They spoke with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian. We'll have the second part of his documentary tomorrow. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.